Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Let me tell you something about Paul Newman.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 402 for the week of April 11th, 2022. I am an Evening at the Improv backdrop, David T. Cole, and I'm here with piggybacker, Sarah D. Bunting.
Ow.
This is my wife of almost 25 years, Tara Ariano.
Or have we been married that long?
And a likely story, Dan Cazito.
It's a lie.
Welcome to Extra Hot Grape for another week. Joining us, he is a professor in the field of political science, but you may know him best as the great American pop culture quiz show scoremaster, Dan. It's Dr. Dan Cazino. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Dan.
Thrilled to be here, as always, especially talking about one of my special areas of expertise, often terrible British programming.
That's right. So we are here to talk about Would I Lie to You, which was originally a BBC panel show, still is, still on. Two team leaders, comic actors, are assigned two teammates for each episode. The object of the game, such as it is, involves making outlandish statements that members of the opposing team interrogate in order to determine whether they're true or not. Sometimes the host joins in the BBC, it's Rob Brydon. And as with all British panel shows, the points don't matter and the shows are just comedies in quasi-game show form. And the CW's version of Would I Lie to You, which premiered last weekend, is extremely faithful to the original, down to the patter, as they introduce each round. Here we have host Asif Manvi and two team leaders, Canadian stand-up comic Sabrina Jalisse and actor and sketch comic Matt Walsh. Guest panelists in the episodes we watched are nearly all comedians or comic actors. And here's a real weird PS. Robert and Michelle King, co-creators of The Good Wife and The Good Fight, put this out through their production company.
Sure.
Okay. Only one episode has aired so far on the CW. We got screeners of the first three. Let's do the Chen check-in. Dan, should our listeners watch the CW's Would I Lie to You?
Qualified yes from me.
Okay. Sarah?
Qualified yes as well.
Dave?
I enjoyed it. I say yes.
Yeah, I'm not mad at it. I think, you know, if you've run out of all of the classic Wilties on YouTube, this is a fine method.
Yeah.
So let's get into it. Dan, what aspects of the original series hooked you, made you watch it? Did you feel they were present here?
This is, as you said, very, very faithful to the original series. I think there's a bit of a different energy coming. So We basically don't have someone who's like David Mitchell, who I think is the heart of the British one, who is, if you don't know, this super posh British guy who looks like he just came out of a Gilbert and Sullivan opera. And he is, and that is where a lot of the comedy comes from. And we don't have anyone who's that type. Mm-hmm. And we got a hint of that in one of the episodes when we had John Hodgman on. And when you get someone like that on, it's like, oh, this is what this show was supposed to be. It is so much better than you've got Preet Bharara on, who was just sucking all the energy out of the room.
Yeah. I agree.
Wow.
He was the only one that wasn't, of the three episodes that we watched, he was the only guest panelist who wasn't at least a comic actor. And I noticed that his screen time was quite limited. But this is also sometimes a problem on the British show, where they'll have someone on who's like a presenter of a morning show that you've never heard of because you're not British, or a radio DJ or an athlete or something, and they just like are not up to it.
Okay, but the difference there is, because you've got such good hosts, they've been doing this, they're in the 15th series over in England, they've been for so long, there's a base level of quality. And what I picked up from these episodes was, when you had Preet Bharara on there, it's like, oh, this episode does not, that was the first one I watched, and I thought, oh, this is bad. Like, I don't know what's wrong with it, but it's bad.
Right.
And then watch the other one, you get Richard Kind in there, and it's an amazing episode.
Yeah.
So I think the quality level is going to vary a lot more. And in the British one, they'll get someone from Love Island on there, and it's awful. That guy's an idiot. But they kind of make fun of him and move on. I'm not sure they can do that on this show yet.
Right. Sarah, this was your first exposure to the format. What were your thoughts?
One of those things where if you have nothing else going on, like in the room at the time, it's fine. But if you're doing other things, it's also fine. Mm-hmm. But I would say that the American version, like there is more dead air in it somehow still.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure why that is. I'm not sure if it's because to American ears, like sometimes you have to be paying a bit closer attention to the UK version to make sure that you get, you know, like sometimes the accents can fog things up. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's a joke about British culture that we just have no, like, I don't watch soccer. I don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
Footy, mm-hmm. whatever. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's part of it. But there was in some episodes of the US one, this almost desperate energy to like fill every second the way the UK version seems to be just like denser for mm-hmm. some reason. And I don't know if that's editing, if it's experience with these panelists and this host, but either way, like even the US version, I did watch a British Wiltie and I thought it was much funnier. I don't know why my exposure to these shows always there's like potatoes involved, but I mean, it's fine.
Yeah. For listeners, it was an episode where Greg Davies was the guest panelist. So that's part of it.
They just seem more relaxed and not trying as hard at times. But mm-hmm. even the sort of lesser episodes of the US version that I watched were fine. Like I wasn't bored or sort of drumming my fingers. I think that it can kind of adapt to whether you're second screening or doing a craft or mm-hmm. whatever. So I think it's fine. I was actually expecting it to be worse and a little more sort of frenzied and trying too hard, but it's good. It's fine.
Sarah, I think you're absolutely right that the energy is kind of weird. And I think that gets picked up with Asif Manvi, who is jumping in a lot more than Rob Brydon does in the original. Because I think Asif mm-hmm. Manvi knows when it's dragging, is like, okay, I'm going to jump in and fix this. And they're giving him a lot more to do. And I think is because he is kind of a higher caliber than everyone else there, and he knows it.
Right. Another problem, I think, with the energy, and also I think it speaks to the pacing and how much people are talking and when they're talking, is that British comedy is much more willing to take the piss out of a person, whereas American, like, it's always like laugh at in England versus yeah. laugh with mm-hmm. in America, generally speaking. The British one definitely takes the piss out of each other more often, mm-hmm. and that gives them two avenues of attack, right? You're attacking the character of the person talking, but you're also attacking the story and the elements of it, whereas the American one is more about dissecting the story itself and not mm-hmm. so much about that sort of particular British willingness to take a knife and turn it in the stomach.
Including on themselves.
Yeah, which absolutely. Also helps.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a big part of the chemistry of the British version is that, as Dan said, they've been doing this for 15 seasons. A lot of the humor comes from what the audience knows about the three fixtures on the show and what they know about each other. So there are sort of go-to jokes they go to. Obviously, the three fixtures on the American version don't have that chemistry yet and may not get to have it. I just, you know, I don't think it's bad. I just don't see it lasting. It doesn't feel like a CW show to me. But the other problem yeah. is, in terms of the pacing, we're going from a BBC half hour without commercials to this where it felt much more cut up. And I felt like there was not, as dumb as this sounds, because the game doesn't matter. There didn't feel like enough time for me to interrogate the question or the statements as much as you get in the British version. Like, and that's where a lot of the humor comes from too, where they get into weird avenues of like, and then, you know, it was my birthday or whatever it is. Like they just felt like they got to it much more quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also like that, plus they're doing less segments as well. Like I don't think the American version does like the rapid fire thing at the end just to fill
they
up
don't,
time.
And I was bummed about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they're doing less segments and shorter ones within it. Like I was, yeah, I also noted that the host often would be like, all right, well, now it's time to make a decision. And I'm like, well, that was quick. Didn't seem like yeah. enough information presented. And why not just, if you have to do a tight 22, just make the decision to axe one of the segments in order to let the other ones breathe.
Yeah.
In order to really get into it. Like the classic examples on the British one, like Bob Mortimer talking about his lion robot and all this kind of stuff that just go on and on and get more ridiculous the more you hear about it. Mm-hmm. You couldn't do that in the way that this one is paced and edited here on the CW. And it's also strange that the CW is taking a crack at this one after canceling their Taskmaster experiment after a third of an episode, whatever one they did.
Yeah,
they pulled the plug right in the middle of it and just like Betty Boop cartoons for the next 20 minutes or something, whatever they did. I mean, I understand why this is cheap as shit. Like you spend $50,000 on a set and that's pretty much your cost. The rest is just storytelling. But if there's a segment they really would like Americans to start enjoying, the cheapest would be great.
Dan, you already opined that Asif Manvi is the strongest of the fixtures on the show. What did you think about Sabrina Jalees and Matt Walsh in their roles?
The biggest problem they have, they both seem reasonably competent in what they're doing. The biggest problem is I don't know anything about them to start with. And that's a problem in the show, because a lot of the comedy of the show is somebody who you know says something very unlikely, right? So you get someone who's, you know, a gardening star in England, which is the thing that happens.
Yeah.
I know, because my mother-in-law watches all their shows. So the best gardener talks about, you know, sexcapades she had in the 1970s.
Right.
And that's weird. And that's what makes the comedy. Mm-hmm. And here, like, I don't know. Oh, is that something Sabrina Jalees would do? Like, I don't know. But then when you get, you know, Richard Kind on there and like, oh, okay, I have an idea who this guy is. So you can get comedy out of what he's saying, what the story is. If I don't know who they are, it's much harder to do that. You have to get types. And I think the British comedy is much more likely to say, this is a posh guy. This is a Scottish guy. You know how Scottish people walk. And so because you have those stereotypes, you can get more comedy out of it. And we're more afraid to do that, I guess. Like our American comedy is much more almost anti-comedy. It's trying for the comedian to not be a type. And I think you kind of do need types for this to work.
Sarah, what did you think?
Well, I didn't really like Jalees all that much. I didn't think she was funny, but I felt compassion for her because not all kinds of comedy translate, and she could fucking kill with a tight 10 at a club, but this is a different animal and not everybody is set up for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, Dan's point stands basically. Like half of the comedy of that Richard Kind bit was that, you know, Paul Newman was tiny. You know who Paul Newman was, you know, Richard Kind is tall.
Yeah.
You're familiar with him. And you're sort of doing some math to be like, okay, was he still alive at that point? And is this something that he would actually do? And the way that Kind told the story was like, okay, that sounds very credible, but also this is what Richard Kind does.
Right.
So that helped it a lot, but then not every guest is going to give you that. And I just think that there's something about, and this was true on Whose Line Is It Anyway? Also, that I think not only the sort of length of time that show was on, but a sort of greater depth of familiarity with everybody who would be on it and pass through it and their various relationships with each other, like that translated a little bit better to the American version, just because I feel like that was always on in rerun somewhere and I was always watching it. So I built that depth of reference.
Yeah.
But I think what you go into the show with in terms of what you know about the panelists is like 60% of the enjoyment. And then the rest of it is just the build of the show, which maybe the US version is fighting the concept a little bit.
Yeah.
For some reason by being like, well, let's get to the points. Like no one cares.
Yeah.
About the points. Stop being such capitalists.
So, Sarah, I think you're actually right on point that's the precedent on the CW for this. It's Whose Line, which is they're saying, what can we do that's like Whose Line? Because, yeah, that ran since the mid-19th century on the CW. Like, it's always been there. And so they need a replacement for that. And I think this is maybe even cheaper than that, because I don't think they have a studio audience. Like, they never show it. There's a lot of laughter. It could all be canned. Who knows? So I think they could do this one for $38 and, you know, some scale. So,
Yeah. So, but given that, it's actually, it's fine. It's not a bad 20 and a half minutes. Given that they, you know, used green stamps to finance it, it's fine.
If they could figure out why, you know, internally, if they can dissect the Richard Kind segment, figure out why that was head and shoulders above anything else in those three episodes.
Yeah.
And do their best to replicate that. I mean, a lot of it was Richard Kind has stories. He's been around a lot of interesting people and he's just like a weird, funny guy.
Mm-hmm.
But that felt to me like you could have picked that up and put it into the British version, no problem.
For sure, yes.
And that felt at home and comfortable and what the show wanted to be. And everything else kind of seemed like they were walking around what they wanted or needed to do, maybe.
Yeah, I hadn't thought that about John Hodgman, but you're so right, Dan, that he's so much more of a natural fit as a team captain. And I agree about Jalyce too, that she's with Sarah, that she seemed lost. Like there was a moment where she couldn't even improvise. Like, what's the opposite of, like, she, you know, says to one of her teammates, well, you're like a cutie sweetie. And then you, and me, indicating John Hodgman, and then like couldn't finish the sentence to say that he's the opposite. Like, it's right there. Like, you need to be quicker than this if you're going to do something like this. Like,
yeah. And it happened in a couple episodes that she was just flat footed. And sometimes her teammates could bail her out by doing a bit around it, but you shouldn't have to. Like, if she's the team leader, no.
Yeah, you want someone like John Hodgman on one side and someone like a Michelle Buteau, for example. Like, she would be great at something like this, who's also a comic and it just has a big personality and is going to be able to fill those awkward silences with, like, just more personality, because sometimes that's what you need if you're going to, you know, build this up to be the institution that it is in the UK. That was a lot of criticism, and yet we all kind of thought it was fine, you know?
But again, like, the original on YouTube maybe is the better use of the time if you like the concept. But yeah, this is fine.
I gotta say, I think you're absolutely right about, you know, John Hodgman be a great host. Honestly, you know, it should be Jeff Foxworthy. It should be somebody like, we know who that guy is. I don't like him, but people do. And if Jeff Foxworthy tells me a story, I can immediately judge whether that's valid or not. You know, that's what they need to be going for. It can't be unknowns. Although, again, they'd probably have to pay them more than $8. So.
Or hear me out. Since everybody just knows everybody involved in Whose Line Is It Anyway, just hire everybody who was on Whose Line Is It Anyway, and this is their new show.
Yes. I mean, it Colin versus Ryan.
It's lazy, but it would be fast out of the gate.
Yeah. Here with a highbrow, lowbrow. First, Minx, medium brow. It's 1972. Joyce Prigger, Ophelia Lovibond, is an aspiring editor with dreams of launching a feminist magazine called The Matriarchy Awakens. Unfortunately, none of the big publishers she pitches at an industry event is interested in the strident, humorless ideas she's been honing since she was a kid. But one guy, Doug Renetti, played by Jake Johnson, who is great, thinks there may be the germ of a good concept in there somewhere. His company, Bottom Dollar, publishes porn magazines targeted at straight men, but the world is changing, and maybe the time is right for an erotic magazine for women called Minx. Sidebar, much better title for a magazine like this than Playgirl. Promising that Joyce can use this format to sneak in actually compelling feminist content around the salacious, dickful pictorials. And our friend Catherine Van Arendonk reviewed the show when it premiered a few weeks ago. She homed in on the show's biggest problem, which is Joyce. Every episode so far has her taking a principled stance on something or other where she doesn't actually know what she's talking about and requiring everyone else around her to educate her on whatever it is that she doesn't understand. And the show knows she's annoying. Even Joyce realizes sometimes how annoying she is, but every stage of making the magazine just presents new shit that she's ignorant about. So a lot of the time, I at least am yelling at her through the TV, no, Joyce, you can't just let your first centerfold pull his photo because he's mad at you. He signed a contract. Never mind, the issue is also on its way to getting printed already. Shut up, Joyce. Fortunately, literally everyone else in the cast is so great. You can just wait for the show to get back to them. Lennon Parham from Playing House plays Joyce's married sister, Shelley, who hangs out at the magazine to support Joyce and then eventually takes a part-time job there. Doug has assigned Bambi. Jessica Lowe, who we just saw playing Lindy Listens on The Righteous Gemstones, is assisting Joyce. She's a former model trying to reinvent herself. Adara Victor plays Tina, who is Doug's assistant slash second in command. And Jake Johnson is, of course, a delight. This is the role he was meant to play. The 70s polyester shirts unbuttoned to his navel look a lot better on him than they do on John C. Reilly as Jerry Buss in Winning Time. Catherine wrote, Jake Johnson with a shirt unbuttoned halfway down his chest will only take a show so far, and Minx is dedicated in its pursuit of testing exactly how far that is. Turns out pretty far. Be aware, it is absolutely packed with penises, all prosthetic, which some commentators have noticed runs counter to a lot of the show's rhetoric around the female gaze and so on. There are also boobs. Those are real, or, you know, real. It's a fun sitcom that will remind you of the first half of Boogie Nights before shit gets real dark. Also has good girls revolt vibes. It's on HBO Max. The last two episodes of the season are dropping this Thursday, so if you just want to wait and binge them all, you can. Dave, you've also been watching the show with me.
Yes, it is an enjoyable ride. It is just, like, very popcorny, when it wants to be. You know, it has a very light sort of adventurous flair sometimes, you know, when they have to like solve publishing problems.
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
How do you do distribution when you're on the outs with the mob? And there's like mm-hmm. a whole thing about how to fix that. So it's, yeah. it's,
buy it a nickel.
It's kind of like The Mandalorian. Each episode is like a little fetch quest sometimes.
It's true.
And yeah. The Mandalorian.
It's kind of amusing mm-hmm. in that way. And Jake is amazing in this. It really is what he was meant to do.
Yeah.
He is the star of the show for sure.
He's really funny. This week, I also watched The Ultimatum, The Lowest of Brows. He brought us Married at First Sight. He brought us Love is Blind. Now Chris Colan, Chaos King, has struck reality gold again. He is back on Netflix with a new relationship show called The Ultimatum. This one is about couples who have been dating for a while. In each couple, one person really wants to get married and the other is not sure. So obviously the way to figure out whatever their issues are is to go on a reality show where they just try breaking up. And they start with six couples. They are all straight couples in this case. I did see a story last week that claimed season two would be all queer couples. So you can also ask, are gay people okay? Because you will definitely be asking that about straight people after you watch the show. Because mm-hmm. of patriarchy, you probably think it's all the women who are trying to nag their way into marriage. It's actually just most of the women. Two of the guys are dying to get married. One just because he's really into his girlfriend, I guess. And the other because he really wants to have kids and his girlfriend's not sure. They spend a few days having extremely superficial conversations with each other around the hotel in Austin, by the way, where they're all staying. And then there's a big summit where they basically have to swipe on each other live. One person gets up and says who they want to pick to live with for a 2-week trial marriage. And if that person also wants to live with them, then they move in together. This all happens in the third episode, in the course of which some wild shit goes down. I won't spoil it, but as dull as the small talk is in the first two episodes, I don't know how much impact the payoff in episode three would be if you didn't know it. I don't advocate watching TV at faster than 1.0 speeds. I will make an exception in this case. I gather that after the 2 weeks with the new person are done, they go back to their original partner for comparison purposes. I haven't watched the whole season yet. And then after that, they have to decide if they're going to get married or break up. I assume it goes without saying, none of these people should be marrying anyone else who would do this show. All of them are way too young to be thinking about marriage at all. Never mind bullying their way into it. One of them is only 23. Like, I'm not sure she'd even be dating yet. And is like, I've been dating Jake for 2 years. Like, you don't know anything about anything. You started dating when you were barely old enough to drink. Like, if you can't rent a car, you should not be having these conversations. But anyway.
I was just going to say that. Thank you.
As with Love is Blind.
Hey, Tara, how old were you when you got married?
I was 22, but I'm different.
Mm.
As with Love is Blind, they have exclusively cast beautiful dum-dums, except where they have cast conventionally attractive monsters. All of them have extremely deep emotional issues that they have chosen to display on Netflix instead of solving in therapy. I support them. There's truly something hypnotic in watching the stupidest people you've ever seen blundering at each other using pop psych terms they barely understand. I hope Chris Colan outlives me because I don't want to live in a world where he's not making more irresponsible dating shows for me. The Ultimatum, recommend. For my plug, Listen to Sassy Club. This is the Patreon arm of our sister podcast, Listen to Sassy. And coming up at the end of this month on April 30th, we are going to have a Zoom watch along exclusively for Patreons. They voted. They picked. We're watching Roadhouse. So if you want to get in on that, if you have $5, and you do. Go to listentosassy.com/club. We will link it in the show notes. And I'll also link Catherine's great review of Minx.
All right, Mr. Casino, what do you have for us?
So we have a new winner in the race to be the most bonkers show on streaming television. The previous winner was, of course, Pennyworth, which is the show where Batman's butler hangs out with Jack the Ripper and dates the queen, who then gets blown up.
Yeah.
Our new winner is Be Foreigners. This is an HBO Nordic presentation presented in Norwegian with subtitles. Here's the plot. In Norway, in the near future, suddenly people from history start washing up on the shore. They are exclusive in three periods. It is cavemen who do not wear pants. It is Vikings. And it is people from Ibsen plays. Because what do they have costumes lying around for? Ibsen plays and Vikings. Okay. So Vikings and 19th century Victorians start washing up on the shore. And this becomes a social sci-fi, like it's 1975, about refugees, but they're time refugees. So Now, that's social sci-fi. That's fine. Except the show is actually about when the murders begin, and we have the police officer who's teamed up with the first Viking to become a police officer, but there's tension. After all, she says she was just a farmer's wife back in the Viking times. She was actually a shield maiden for a guy who killed a Christian saint. Oh my God, what's going to happen? The show is bonkers. Speaking of plenty of dicks, the cavemen don't wear pants. They're just wandering around everywhere. It is pretty smart social satire, sometimes a little on the nose. Oh, there's people sacrificing animals. Gets at the tensions with refugees in Scandinavian culture, but is also just absolutely bonkers. And the second season, there's two seasons currently streaming on HBO Max, is even bonkerser, where they decide, oh no, it's not just time travel. There's also dimensional travel and also Jack the Ripper, because why not?
Hey, always Jack the fucking Ripper, man.
Hey, where did he go? Maybe he fell into a time portal and wound up in 21st century Norway. Who knows? The show is bonkers. It is actually a pretty well done procedural because it's Norwegian. For some reason, I have faith that their Lost style long game about what's really going on with the time portals will actually pay off. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's misplaced. I guess I just trust Norwegian people. but it is very entertaining. It's got a great procedural element where they're solving one crime every episode, but then they are building towards the larger thing. And again, it's just wild. And I like that sort of wackiness in my TV.
This sounds like extremely Dave shit. Dave, I apologize that I didn't already know about this show.
That's okay.
I recommend we watch it.
I saw the title Beforeigners on the screen at some point, and mm-hmm. I thought, I can't watch something called Beforeigners, but now I have to. It sounds like somebody thought, you know what's really boring and stupid? Alien Nation. Let's see if we can jazz that up 1,000%. Hearing Dan's explanation of it takes me there.
Yeah,
but with like Norwegian Tourism Bureau elements. Thanks for the sponsorship. By the way, speaking of would I lie to you, Dan Cassino is not lying to you. I thought it was possible. I just Googled it. The show does exist.
Also, I will say it is a triumph of production design because this show built around to like, I don't know, what costumes do we have? Like Ibsen and Vikings. Go. Make a show with that. And they did it. For my plugs, of course, I write a bunch of questions for the Great American Pop Culture Quiz Show with David T. Cole. We are just about to move into our new season, so we're currently doing some special episodes. We have some very special episodes coming up, so hope you'll tune in for those, including what I think might be the longest recording we've ever had. So good luck cutting that one down, Dave.
Yep.
In addition to that, you can also get my new book. So I have a new book out called Gender Threat, American Masculinity in the Face of Change. It is written with my partner and wife, Yasmin Pesen Cassino, and it makes a great gift for a very, very small percentage of people. So if that sounds all interesting to you, you can check out a piece I did in the Washington Post a couple weeks ago to find out what that book is all about.
30 budding.
I have a highbrow and a highbrow. The first one is very brief. It's about Julia. This is definitely one of those shows that I was like, it cannot be this good and satisfying as everyone is saying on Twitter and has been saying on, you know, Extra Hot Great. It absolutely is. Occasionally, it has an anachronistic way of letting its characters express itself. Like, I think someone drops a what the fuck at some point. But, like, everything else about the production is such a delight to look at, to listen to spend time with. I don't care about, like, little errors or anachronisms. It is a feast for the mid-century fashion and design nuts' eyes, and Avis is my president. I will not be taking questions. Mm-hmm. She is the best.
Yep.
My other discussion topic is Atlanta.
Woo!
Which I feel like it sort of snuck back onto the air last month. I just don't feel like I've heard or seen anyone talking about it, although that cannot be true. Certainly the third season premiere got onto my radar, whether I wanted it to or not, which obviously I did, because it was basically an Urn's Nightmare recreation of the Heart case, which is somehow even more upsetting than the actual case on Atlanta, even though the disposition here is somewhat recent Tarantino-esque in that it reimagines the outcome and rewrites an atrocity in favor of justice, or more justice, a la Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. If you are not familiar with the Heart case, I don't want to bring the entire room down like forever. So I will let you pause this and Google the phrase broken hearts, H-A-R-T-S, while issuing an extremely stern and sincere content warning for harm to children. oh, hello, you're back. Hi, hope you're okay. I know that was a lot. I had embarked on a full series Atlanta rewatch a couple of weeks back anyway. I was trying to confine myself to one episode a day. This was not possible to do because the show is so amazing that it even gets me to use the word immersive, which I hate doing. And I highly recommend rewatching it if you had not realized that the third season was back, or you did and you just sort of started up again with it. The show was off for a while.
Yeah.
Like sort of marinating yourself in its world with the first two seasons first. Like, it's just never a bad idea, even if the third season wasn't on yet. But it does make the transition into that third season premiere a little easier to take emotionally. If you've been spending time with these characters and with the Glovers, sometimes disgusted, sometimes grieving, always confident storytelling, especially around the criminal justice entertainment complex. If you've watched Streets on Lock from the first season, if you've been listening to Darius talking about Florida Man, if you've seen the way the show turns a shooting at a club into a pitch dark runner involving an invisible car, and you've seen Teddy Perkins, which is not getting any less powerful, despite the fact that I've now seen it, I think, conservatively a dozen times because I had to teach it in a class, it's still a stunner. If you have all these episodes on board a little more recently, it's a little easier to resume with season three. Just my opinion. But it's also really a perfect time for Atlanta to come back because it's comfort with non-endings and truth is stranger than fiction qualities of life as it's lived. Not that that didn't work in the before time, but here in 2022, we absolutely need Paperboy furiously taking a chainsaw to a billionaire's pet old growth tree to settle a debt more than ever. And last note, everyone in that cast is aces, obviously, but Brian Tyree Henry's simmering glares are highly underrated, and everyone needs to be getting some Emmy love on that show.
Mm-hmm.
Also highly underrated, my true crime review blog, Best Evidence. I write it with Eve Beatty. Sometimes Dan Cassino graces us with his presence, and we'll be talking a little bit about Atlanta this week, actually, along with a Channel 4 miniseries from last year, Edgar Award nominees, and other true crime that is and is not worth your time. You can find all of that at bestevidence.fyi.
Today's extra credit topic comes to us from Dave S. It's called Mystery Date, and he writes, NBC's The Courtship doesn't seem poised to set the world on fire. This is, I'm breaking in here to say, so true that since Dave S. submitted this topic, the show got dumped from NBC to USA. Is there a historical cosplay dating show concept you would actually want to watch? Or if that's too niche, just a high concept dating show gimmick that hasn't yet been exhausted. Please reinvent this wheel. Dan Cassino, start us off.
Absolutely. So this is not my genre. Normally, I try and avoid these shows because I like to retain faith in humanity. So in order to find out, like, what could we do here? I went and looked at the best-selling romance novels, because, of course, where Bridgerton and Courtship comes from, that these sort of Regency romances, Victorian romances, are very hot. People like those in the romance novels. So, all right, what other genre could we get and turn into a show? And so I present to you a dating show based entirely around paranormal romances. So this is essentially sexy beasts,
yep,
but it's in period clothing. Mm-hmm. So there's a bunch of suitors and you have to pick a suitor, but one of those suitors is a Dracula. And maybe we're going to change it up. And maybe one of those suitors is also a werewolf. Maybe one's a gill man. I don't know. And you have to pick which is your suitor while also trying to not pick the vampire. So we are combining the game of werewolf with your dating game, with maybe a little Murder in Small Town X thrown in there, because I was the one guy who watched that show.
Mm-hmm. And is it cake? Is it blood? Love it. I'd watch that.
And, yeah, I think this comes, at that point, a four-quadrant hit, because small children love the vampires, and women are going to like the dating part, and everyone's going to turn in to find out if it is, in fact, cake.
Dan, you want to plug your book again?
I was thinking it. Hi, it's me, Buncey, the only person who watched every episode of I Want to Marry Harry, except possibly also Jessica Morgan. But Jess, if I am slandering you with that, at me and I will issue an apology. From the quarter wits who brought you that show, it's I Want to Marry Henry the Eighth. Six candidates costumed in period clothing will vie for the affections of some stocky bearded Nigel or another in a Top Chef Last Chance Kitchen style face-off each week, featuring challenges like Tasty and Spotted Dick, Tower of London climb, build your own guillotine out of Legos, and bear baiting. The bear will be my dog, Bear, a 22-pound Spitz. Will the losers each week survive the taping? You'll have to watch to find out whether the real channel is airing the first competition romance snuff show. It's I Want to Marry Henry. The eighth! Tara.
Well, the period I'm going to is the year 3000, because my inspiration is the Futurama episode, Why Must I Be a Crustacean in Love, season 2, episode 5. This is basically The Bachelorette, except the bachelors, all decapodians groaning with male jelly, need to attract the bachelorette by standing on a sand mound, covering themselves in rancid sea detritus, and putting on the most seductive display of movement and screeching. After the bachelorette has chosen, one of the rejected bachelors may challenge him to a fight to the death, aka Clauplach. Obviously, whichever one survives is the worthier mate. If people are going to be weird about televising Mortal Kombat, they can do laser tag or something instead. Dave.
I also went futuristic because I just went for the costume idea first. And I thought, well, let's just make sure everybody is dressed up in the retro sci-fi fashions of, like, let's say the 40s all the way up to like 1980 or so. We're talking, you know, glittery silver jumpsuits, lame everything. We're going to put people inside Robbie the Robot shells. We're going to put them under the octopus from Ed Wood, all this kind of stuff. So it's sort of like a blind date situation, kind of like Sexy Beast as well, where you can't see them without tons of makeup or helmets and astronaut suits and stuff like that. But then, like, all the challenges, all the ways they meet are all ridiculous tropes of retro science fiction. Like, they meet for dinner, but it's all just food cubes, and they have to guess what the food cubes actually are, you know, and some of them are great and some of them taste like crap. Just a lot of science fiction-y things like that. When you get eliminated, you get science fiction-y beamed out of it and you just disappear. You don't get to say goodbye or anything like that. You're just instantly done, so you don't have to deal with all of that kind of stuff. So It's basically just a dating show concept, and a dating show is something that I hate. So it's just filled with stupid science fiction stuff. And the moment where you figure out it's not working, that person immediately leaves the show.
Hi, Sarah, Tara, Dave, and valued guest. It's Francoise. As a huge Top Chef fan, I was genuinely surprised no episode of Top Chef has ever been pitched for the canon. It's actually kind of hard. There's no one unifying Top Chef moment. No, we were all rooting for you, Tiffany, episode that is instantly iconic. For the most part, it's really talented chefs making beautiful food that you can't taste. So what to choose for the canon? I think the most Top Chef-y of Top Chef episodes are the Restaurant Wars, where two teams go head-to-head, popping up a restaurant in a matter of hours with unnecessary constraints. And what I want in a Restaurant Wars episode is one team of underdogs to knock it out of the park and one team of overconfident assholes to fully crash and burn. That is what I want in a Restaurant Wars, and that is what I present to you from Season 8, the first Top Chef All-Star season. But first, the quickfire. Later Top Chef Restaurant Wars episodes dropped the quickfire, which I think is too bad. And in this case, this is a great quickfire. It's hosted by Tony Bourdain, because the apparently, I am Extra Hot Grade's Tony Bourdain correspondent, and it's my favorite kind of quickfire, which is skills-based.
At a restaurant of this level, the wrong person comes in here, gets one scale in their piece of fish, suddenly it's a it-used-to-be-good situation. Josco, thank you very much. Chefs, I think we know what comes next. Chefs, for this quickfire challenge, each of you will portion one cod and one fluke into Le Bernardin quality portions, or as close to that standard as you can get. My comrade, Mr. Thomas here, can accomplish this task in 8 minutes. You will have the relatively luxurious amount of time of 10 minutes.
I love that this salutes an unsung hero of the restaurant. I love that we can all see if the chefs are good or bad at this. And I like the twist at the end that the chefs have to use the waste to make something delicious. It's satisfying all around. But of course, we are here to see one restaurant crash and burn.
Dale, you won the quickfire, so you're one team captain. And it's up to you to decide the captain of the other team.
It's really about chemistry for me. It's who I don't want to work with.
Marcel.
I know I don't work well with him, so I put him on the other team to be as far away from him as possible.
I feel honored. I feel as though I have the opportunity to kind of like take the bull by the horns.
On one team, Dale, Fabio, Trey, Richard Blaze, and American treasure Carla Hall. On the other team, Angelo, Tiffany, Antonia, history's greatest monster, Mike Isabella, and history's other greatest monster, Marcel. Dale's team is vibing. They have a super fun concept, elevated bodega, high-end tuna served in a can, fancy chips, bacon, egg, and cheese. Marcel's team.
I'm kind of a fan of Medi, because I mean, our flavors are all like Mediterranean.
Maybe it's just me because, you know, I've been working on concepts in restaurants and I wanted everything to make sense for my restaurant.
As it should.
You're saying that we don't have a vision?
I'm saying Medi and Mediterranean just means an abbreviation to me.
Okay, Medi is my idea and it's up there. You know what I mean? And until we come up with a better idea, it's still there.
Just to be fair, if one person has one theory and there's four other people that have the same theories, then we should go with the four theories.
Sure.
Is that fair?
Yeah.
Off to a great start, guys. On the day of service, Team Bodega is working well together. Fabio starts setting up the front of house. Food is looking good and tasting good. On Marcel's team, he's making unnecessary foams. He's mansplaining egg cookery.
Tiffany.
Yeah?
After they're all cooked and shocked, they peel a lot better when they're ice cold.
Yes, I know.
And then after we peel them...
Yes, chef. Teach me how to cook an egg.
Service starts. On Team Bodega, Fabio is crushing front of house. They're making Corona sauce. Fabio's dessert makes Tony curse in a good way. It's fun. It's creative. It's smooth sailing. On Team Etch, food immediately starts getting sent back. There's the always iconic scene of judges arriving to an empty host stand. The vibe is bad. The chefs are sniping back in the kitchen. Tiffany's laugh echoes over silent diners. And Dana Cowan, my God, Dana Cowan does not like the food.
It's not appealing to eat a piece of meat that doesn't look like it's cooked.
Yeah, I thought that it's not a well-cooked egg.
Right.
It's not balanced in the way that it's composed.
And okay. It's also like too salty, and you just sort of lost the kind of like the beauty of that kind of salad.
It was more like it imploded.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. I'm sorry that you had to experience it this way.
Brutal criticism. I am here for it. And of course, it ends with one of Marcel's signature stunts.
It's something steaming.
Of course it is.
It is. It's a duo of peaches, coconut foam, and a little bit of coconut powder. This is, I guess you could say Marcel's. It's a couple hands in it, though.
What is that green? I'm scared of the green.
They're all focused around the dry ice coming out of.
So this is all presentation.
It was like a perfect storm.
At judge's table, Bodega wins with nothing but compliments. Team Etch, however, just gets brutalized by the judges. Pink peppercorns are not found in the south of France. The oxtail ragu is too salty. The asparagus has no flavor. And the eternal question.
Why foam? Why now?
The finger pointing, the drama, the shouting. This is why we're here. And then catharsis. Marcel, a dick to the bitter end, gets sent home. What we want in a restaurant wars is a low-ego team that crushes it and a high-drama team that makes us cringe when it all falls apart. This episode has the highs and lows, the drama and the triumph, delicious food, and idiotic foam. It is a pretty perfect episode of Top Chef. So I leave you with three questions.
Why foam? Why now?
And will you vote this episode into the canon?
Thank you, Francoise. Dan, you chose this from our list of submissions. Please begin.
So first off, I'm absolutely with Francoise that it's a shame that there's no Top Chef in the canon. And this is a good episode, I would say, more than on the editing, because they actually do manage to create some tension, because the one team, Dale's team, is so far above everybody else. And Marcel's team is pretty heavily the whole time just looking to throw Marcel in the bus. Like, they want to lose and kick Marcel out too. Everyone wants Marcel gone. My notes aren't entirely fuck Marcel, but there's a lot of that in there. I hate that guy. That said, I'm not sure this is a shoe-in for the canon, because I'm not sure this is what I want to have a Top Chef episode. Look, the quick fire I was aggravated at. I was aggravated at a couple reasons. Number one, no one in high-end chef is cutting their own fish. You buy it portioned. Come on. Number two, in the middle of it, Fabio cuts his finger open and keeps on doing it. And that is 3 health code violations right there. There's a reason they put finger covers on there. I didn't know what they were in my house when I was a small boy. My parents were both chefs. And so it confused me for years trying to think about it. So it also means that we don't have enough time for the real process of cooking, which is what I want out of a Top Chef episode. So the best part of this episode is, yeah, it gives us that catharsis. Yes, Marcel gets kicked out. He gets thrown under the bus. Everybody hates Marcel. They lose spectacularly. And the editing gives us some tension. You think, oh no, was that confidence? Or was that hubris? Oh my God, what if they lose? It also gives us great stuff like Richard Blaze's hair, which at this point is flying so high up in the air. He's like Goku about to go Super Saiyan. He's at level 9,000. Looks amazing. The food looks pretty good. They do make some weird decisions. The judges' table's good. But again, it doesn't give me the process. And I really want them to dig into what this dish is. How do they make it? Does it work? And we don't have enough time for that in a Restaurant Wars episode.
Sarah.
Yeah. I'm sort of on the fence with this. This was an excellent presentation. Despite the, Dan Cassino put a trigger warning for Marcel content in our rundown doc. And yes, that is advised. Marcel is so frustrating because just when you think that it's like, oh, he's finally figured out how to get along with people. No. And then don't put me in a position of picking whose side I'm on, him or Mike Isabella. Ugh. But this was like definitely an entertaining episode. There is definitely catharsis, as Francoise said, with Marcel getting kicked off. But I'm kind of with Dan in that, well, first of all, I think the show has actually gotten a lot better in the last few seasons. I'm not exactly sure why that is. I think Padma has gotten over herself a little bit and is just like kind of leaning into the more like stoned, I'm actually here to learn from you persona. It seems more focused on the actual cooking and less on the drama, which I think when this show first started, they were very much focused on, like, it's, you know, Project Runway, but with food, and they wanted there to be strife and, you know, Morganza staying out all night at the club, except with the chef's knives instead of her outfit or whatever. Kids, ask your grandparents. But I think that that was not as good a version of the show, which I have watched throughout all like gazillion seasons of it, as it is now. So going back to that first All-Star season and seeing that it is being edited a little more for the interpersonal drama, which you can't avoid with Marcel because he's a dick, versus the drama of the art or craft that they're working on, that's a little like a mark against it, I would say, in terms of it going into the canon. But at the same time, Restaurant Wars-y episodes are both extremely typical of Top Chef and atypical of Top Chef. I don't think it shows Top Chef at its best, to its best advantage. But, I mean, this episode is extremely watchable. Anytime Bourdain comes in, is just like, you fucking guys, to the contestants, is like, yes, always here for that. Wish it were still happening. I think Repair rolls through this episode at one point as well, which, like, you know, that's a double shot of guest judges that I like. But yeah, I mean, this really sort of tests the outlines of the definition of what makes something canon worthy. And while I think this was a great presentation, I was very entertained by this episode. I think trying to define what is a typical Top Chef and is this like the sort of good Top Chef, I'm not sure I am there with it, but I'm probably overthinking it. So why doesn't someone else talk for a while?
Okay, I'll go next. I mean, Francoise said it in her presentation. It's about beautiful food that you can't taste, which is always the problem with the show for me. It's like, you have to take everyone's word for it. I'm sure the food is great or terrible, as they say, but it doesn't hit the same as Project Runway for that reason. Like, you can't make those assessments as a viewer. And so there's, you know, I understand the logic of making the show. Obviously, it is very successful. It's doing fine without me because it's in season like 5,000 at this point. But, you know, it's just not that compelling to me. Also, as someone who doesn't care about fancy food. The quick fire, I went back and forth on it. I mean, I thought it was an interesting thing to throw them into. And, you know, given the way Bourdain introduces him, you know, you believe that Eusto Thomas is like this incredible butcher, like 700 to 1,000 pounds of fish every day, like take three guys to replace him when he goes on vacation. Like, okay, but then the editing is so frenetic when they're actually showing what the chef testants are doing. You really can't see like if it's good or not what they're, because they're cutting so much. And, you know, one of them is cutting himself. When it gets to the actual Restaurant Wars part of it, it is very clear from the beginning, like Bodega is a strong concept. If they can execute, they're definitely going to win because they have more of an idea behind it. And that happens.
Right.
I regret to say all of Fabio's bullshit as the front of house guy would like totally work on me trying to
seduce
all the lady diners. I never watched the previous season that Marcel was in, but I lived in culture, so I knew that he was the one everyone hated. And he is loathsome. Like, I get why no one liked him here, and it is satisfying to see him dismissed. But I felt about this episode the same way I felt about that work of art that we talked about a couple of months ago, where it's just like, I don't, and Francoise says that too, like, there isn't really a moment in it where you're like, oh, that's why.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's fun. It's good. I can tell that it's, you know, generally well made. I can understand why it would be of interest if you watch this show. But for me coming in cold, it doesn't, like, it, you know, it's just kind of a shrug for me without all of the context of having watched all these people in their previous seasons. So that's my read. Dave?
Yeah, I think the show is inherently flawed as well for the same reason. Like, okay, I understand you can't eat food on television, but you can show more of the presentation and what goes into making the food. And really, this show, maybe it started that way, but by the time we're here at season 8, episode 7, that in the background and in the foreground to make up for it, it is all about amping up the human drama. And by human drama, I mean petty squabbling that you have in any sort of hierarchical situation, whether it be the army or a kitchen run by a chef. You know, it's all sort of the same thing. You're in an office and you really want the cubicle the other guy has. You know, that sort of pettiness does not work on me. And that's why generally when reality television show hits the canon, it's got to have some moments that are really head and shoulders above business as usual. And this really seems like a business as usual episode. I understand that Marcel, oh, the foam guy, we hate him and he gets what's coming to him here. And that is sort of satisfying, but it's not satisfying in a oh, kind of way, because you see it coming. You see that he's been set up for failure by being the alternate captain picked by the winner because everybody hates him. And, you know, in a show like America's Top Model with Pot Leadum, the ridiculousness of that, or
my God,
of the finale of first season of Survivor at the Tribal Council with Sue going batshit crazy. Like, it needed one of those moments, because there's just like too much here that I can nitpick at and that bothered me. Like, you're talking about the editing and the presentation of all the chef testants doing their fish stuff. But like, even when Anthony Bourdain introduces this wizard fish butcher, they give him the Bourne ultimatum super fight cut. So like, you can't believe that he can. Does he actually work that fast?
Right.
Can't tell, because I don't see it in real time. Like, just give me 5 seconds at least. Mm-hmm. But no, it's all, you know, all chopped up and all crazy. So I feel like even the presentation, the editing is not telling the same story that they want to tell on paper sometimes.
Yeah.
For me. Yeah. There's two things that I really enjoyed about this episode. What I wanted more of was, one, the idea of creating a concept around, you know, a pop-up restaurant, and particularly the bodega one. I wanted to see more of their ideas, the ones that were like on point but didn't make it. I could have used 5 more minutes on that kind of thing. Yeah. I don't think it would have saved the episode for me, but that was, for me, the most interesting part, was that process of developing the menu and the concept and how they're going to execute it.
Yeah.
And the other part, which is actually the best episode, is discovering that the world has given us a real world Calvin peeing on the truck of your choice sticker guy in Richard. That guy is Calvin peeing on your truck sticker guy come to life. And so I will give them kudos for that. But otherwise, this episode did not do it for me. So let's put in the official vote. Dan Cassino, what say you?
I'm going to make a case for the cultural importance of Top Chef, but I think this episode has to be a no.
Sarah D. Bunting?
Yeah, this show might be canon proof, which sucks. But and Françoise, you came close, but it's a no for me too, I'm afraid.
No for me as well, but thank you, Françoise. Please keep submitting. We love your submissions.
All right, that means, unfortunately, Top Chef, Season 8, Episode 7, Restaurant Wars, One Night Only, you're hereby not inducted into the Extra Hot Gray Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for the winner and the loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winner.
I do. It is Better Call Saul. I mean, kind of every week's winner, definitely next week's winner, but the show has confirmed appearances by Bryan Cranston and Aaron Paul in its imminent final season. And if this means Aaron Paul is doing fewer online betting commercials, I am all for it. Thank you, BCS Industrial Complex.
What if they announce all this and it's just them like crossing the opposite side of the street while Saul Goodman's in the foreground? That would be great.
That would be great.
Tara, yeah. Who's our loser?
Our loser is Dancing with the Stars. We referred in the extra credit segment to the courtship getting demoted from NBC to USA. Dancing with the Stars is getting kicked off ABC to Disney Plus. This is a wild decision to me. You know, what we've heard is in the streaming age, the conventional wisdom is that all network TV has to try to hook you really is these big live eventy kind of shows. It doesn't get much more eventy than Dancing with the Stars, which is live, as they tell you 5,000 times per episode. And so if ABC is like, it's fine. If we just put it to Disney Plus, like, that death knell for network TV is just getting louder. I will never give it up, but yeah. Nice try.
No, me neither. This is what you get for firing Tom Bergeron. Sorry.
Right. But also on the other side, it's like, the streaming services that exist outside of Netflix are sort of like positioning themselves as unique premium experiences.
Yeah.
You know, like with Marvel and Star Wars stuff and Disney Plus in particular. Mm-hmm. But when you start throwing network leftovers on it, it sort of cheapens the brand. So, yeah. Like, is this them on the road to Netflixization? You know, you wonder.
Yeah.
Guess we'll see.
We will.
That or the, you know, Teeny Yoda is a contestant next season.
Speaking of being on the road to mediocrity, you know what time it is?
No, it's game time. Goodbye. Already there, hours.
This is the fourth game time of our current season. The scores are Tara with 2 points, value guess 1 point, Sarah looking to get on the board. Today we're playing TV taglines of the 21st century. From Meredith, who earns herself an extra credit topic. I will read you the tagline of a TV show, usually from when it was first debuted in marketing, along with the year it debuted and the network on which it aired. You give me the name of the show. All shows in this game debuted after the year 2000.
Oh.
If you need a hint, I will give you the name of a character from the show. 2 points before the hint, 1 point after. So here's an example. The tagline is, Return to Mars. It's everything you like about Neptune. The show would be
Veronica Mars.
Veronica Mars is correct.
Oh,
yes.
Duh.
Okay. And the hint would have been 2004 CW. And if you need an actor, we could have given you that too.
Okay.
Tara, steel mill situation, please.
Thank you, Dave. Sarah has 13. I have 11. Valued guests have 10 plus Eric's meal. And there is also 2 steel meals that you have yet to distribute, Dave.
Okay. And where we are on everybody's favorite new edition, The Vampire's Kiss?
Is Vampire
that
what we're
I don't remember how that works either. So, yay.
Sarah has 10. I have 1. Valued guests have 2.
Well, let's start to pick a seat. Who's going first?
We will start with valued guest.
All right, Dan, Sarah, Tara, are we ready to play TV taglines of the 21st century?
We'll see.
Yes.
For Dan, from the year 2001 on ABC, I can be anyone I want to be.
Ooh, that sounds like it is The Pretender.
It is not. It is Alias. Alias. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yeah.
2001 CBS. The World is Waiting. Go.
The Amazing Race.
That is good for 2 points.
Woo.
Tara.
Yep.
Obsessive Compulsive Detective 2002 USA.
Monk.
Monk is correct. Back to Dan. Here's our longest tagline of the game, so get ready for a good amount of information. 2002 ABC. Once upon a time, 25 women met the man of their dreams. Unfortunately, they met him all on the same night.
All right, so 2002 ABC, I'm guessing that is the first season of The Bachelor.
The Bachelor is correct. 2 points for Dan. Sarah, 2003 CBS. Two adults, one kid, no grown-ups.
Two and a Half Men?
Two and a Half Men is correct.
Oh, nice.
Ew, sorry. Sorry, yes. I knew that.
2003 on Fox.
Yeah.
It's nothing like Where You Live and nothing like What You Imagine.
2003 on Fox.
You need a hint? I can give you a character from the show.
Yeah, I'll take a hint.
Ryan Atwood is a character on
the
show.
Oh, the OC.
The OC. Good for 1 point. And if you haven't clued in yet, we're going chronologically. Chronologically. So now we're at 2004. HBO for Dan Cassino. His fame is their fortune.
His fame is their fortune.
Correct.
That has to be Entourage.
Entourage, yes.
Oh, nice.
2 points. Good pull. Sarah D. Bunting, 2004 on SIFI. The world is over. The fight has just begun.
The world is over. The fight has just begun. Oh, Battlestar Galactica?
Battlestar Galactica is correct. Yes, 2 points.
It was still sci-fi then.
But it was SIFI in their hearts.
Well, sure.
2005, Tara, on Fox.
Mm-hmm.
Escape is just the beginning.
Prison Break.
Prison Break, yes. Quick answer. Dan Cassino, 2005 on NBC. Karma is a funny thing.
Karma is a funny thing.
Yes.
All right. Can I have a hint, please?
Your character is Earl Hickey.
Oh, my name is Earl.
My name is Earl, a show we all have some personal history with.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah D. Bunting, 2006, NBC. Work can be such a production.
The Office?
Incorrect. That is...
Oh.
30 Rock.
Oh. 30 Rock.
All right. 2006 NBC as well.
Mm-hmm.
Every day counts. One night matters.
That's 30 Rock's ugly evil twin, Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. No,
it is not. The one night is Friday night. Friday night.
Sorry, Tammy Taylor's hair.
Damn.
We love you.
Back to Dan. 2007 on HBO, Born to Folk. Born to Folk.
All right. Well, it's a question of how clever they're trying to be, right? Because my first thought is, well, okay, it could be Queer as Folk. But I'm trying to think that 2007 seems a little too late for that. Okay.
Take the hint.
Yeah, give me the hint, please.
Character name, Jermaine. Jermaine, sorry. No R in there. Jermaine.
Fly of the Conchords.
Fly of the Conchords, yes. Saved it for one. Sarah D. Bunting, 2007, AMC, Where the Truth Lies.
What? Where the Truth Lies?
Yes.
AMC.
2007, AMC. I mean, I feel like this is too late. Anyway, let's try it. Mad Men.
Yes, Mad Men, good for
They're
you.
So mad.
Dara, 2008 now,
yep.
ABC Family.
Mm.
Expect the Unexpected.
Shit. Is this The Secret Life of the American Teenager?
It is. Yes.
Wow. Nice pull.
A show I watched for a while.
Dara, in my household, we still quote that show for, you know what they say about girls from Bologna. It's like, no. Why? What could possibly...
Nothing.
All right, everybody's got one more question before we hit our score break. Dan Cassino, from 2008 on HBO, we have Thou Shall Not Crave Thy Neighbor.
Thou Shall Not Crave Thy Neighbor. So 2008, All right, so what is going on at HBO on 2008? Okay, hint please. I'll take that.
Suki Stackhouse is the character on this show.
Oh, True Blood.
True Blood is good for 1 point. We will now start with question 17.
Spread Eagle.
Which, by the way, everybody on Discord was mind was blown when they all collectively discovered that there was actually a reference there.
And, yeah.
Sarah D. Bunting, 2009, CBS. His Scandal, Her Story.
CBS. His Scandal, Her Story. His Scandal, Her Story. I need a hint, please.
Alicia Florrick.
Oh, Good Wife.
Good Wife. Good for one. Yes. And Tara.
Yeah.
2009.
Yeah.
ABC.
Right.
40 is the new 20.
Cougar Town.
Cougar Town is correct. And that will bring us into our first score break. Let's get the score, Star.
This is an extremely close game. Sarah D. Bunting and I are now tied with 9 points each. Dan barely behind with 7.
Guess what, Dan? That means you are in the Gross Worth People After. All right, Dan, you have your choice of three exciting Trivial Pursuit TV-related boxes. We have the ancient purple tome from the mid-80s. We have the more recent special 90s edition, all about 90s trivia, but published in the aughts. And we have the Pop Culture 2 edition, also published sometime in the aughts. Which one do you want?
I think the old Trivial Pursuit that I remember my parents playing the hell out of, I think that might be too old even for me. So let's go for the 90s.
All right, 90s. Here we go.
Good luck, Dan. Sure. Good luck.
The 90s, by the way, I keep on mentioning this, but they have the bonus of each card is about a particular year. So I'm going to read you the question. You also get the year it is about.
Okay.
So if you get three questions correct, we will give you 3 points. And if you sweep it, we'll give you 6.
Damn.
That's what we're going to do today. 3 and 6.
Oh boy.
Here we go. 1990. Who was the first former Saturday Night Live star to be nominated for an Oscar?
Ooh, SNL star nominated for an Oscar in 1990. I'm going to say Steve Martin.
Dan Aykroyd.
Oh, yeah, for Driving Miss Daisy.
Ah, there we go. Yeah. Thank you, Tara. 1995, Dan. What Canadian TV comedy show buried its 5 stars alive during the credits of the series finale?
The Kids in the Hall.
Kids in the Hall is good. Also 1995. Who left CBS after a strained 2 years as Dan Rather's co-anchor on the CBS Evening News?
Connie Chung.
All right, you only need one more for your 3 points. 1995 again.
Dan is centering himself.
What coffee shop is frequented by Niles and Fraser Crane?
Once you started saying that, I'm like, Central Perk, obviously. Uh-huh. But that's...
I was like, Tom's Restaurant. Anyway.
Oh, shoot. Okay, so... Oh, I can picture it. I can picture where they're doing that. It is Cafe Nervosa.
Yes! There we go.
Nice.
He got his 3. That's all he needs. Tara, update scores, please.
Oh my God, this changed everything. Sarah and I are, of course, still tied with 9. Dan has pulled ahead with 10.
Okay. And we are back to Dan for his actual question. To remind you, I'm going to read you a tagline from a TV show, the year it debuted and the network it started on. You tell me the show. When alcohol was outlawed, outlaws became kings, 2010 HBO.
Boardwalk Empire.
Yes, 2 points.
New Jersey excellence. Mm-hmm.
Sarah D. Bunting, 2010 again, AMC, Fight the Dead, Fear the Living.
The Walking Dead?
Walking Dead, yes. Tara?
Yep.
2011, ABC, Magic is Coming.
Once Upon a Time?
Yes, Once Upon a
Wow,
Time.
Wow, nice pull.
I would have thought that was later.
Back to Dan, 2011, ABC again. What goes around comes around.
All right. Everyone else is doing really well on this, so I don't want to take the hint. I'm just going to guess that this is Revenge.
Revenge is correct. Shit. Nicely sussed out. Sarah.
Yeah.
2012, HBO, The Buck Stops Somewhere Near Here.
Veep.
Yes.
Thank you.
2012, still for Tara, but on NBC.
Okay.
Stars aren't born, they're made.
Smash.
Smash is correct.
Oh, picky.
Dan, how we're now in 2013 on Netflix. Every sentence is a story.
Sentence is a story. All right. So it's got to be that there is a... Yeah, it's got to be... There got to be a sentence as a pun. So it's got to be a legal thing. I'm trying to think that's early... That's a really early Netflix. 2013. So I'm trying... So it's after Lillehammer. But 2013, I think that's...
That's how we judge it. There's BL.
It's after Lillehammer.
And AL. Yes. Yeah. Don't forget, you have a hint if you need it.
That's a fair point right there.
You know what? Oh, no. Early enough, so I'm thinking, it couldn't be House of Cards, but it's because it's Orange is the New Black. It's sentencing. Okay. Yeah.
There you go. You got there. That's why you talk things out. Sarah, 2013 still, NBC, a killer's legend is reborn.
A killer's legend is reborn on NBC.
And let's just go ahead and say 2013. Hint, you say? Yes. Will Graham.
Oh, Jesus. Hannibal.
Hannibal, 1 point. Tara.
Yep.
2014 on FX. Ah, geez, here we go again.
Fargo.
Fargo, yes. Dan, 2014 on Starz. What if your future was the past?
Future was the past. Stars. My first thought was Black Sails, because that's a Stars show from about that time.
That is the first time that somebody has gone to Black Sails first. Congratulations. Another extra hot great first.
They gave me a bunch of swag at Comic-Con. This is Outlander.
Outlander! Yes, correct. Sarah.
Yep.
2015 on the CW. Kicking ass and taking brains.
iZombie.
iZombie, yes. Tara.
Yep.
2015 Fox. Music, family, power, the battle begins.
Empire,
yes. Dan, 2016 Netflix. The world is turning upside down.
World is turning upside down. All right, I'm going to need a hint for that.
Joyce Byers.
Joyce Byers. God, I don't know.
The World is Turning Upside Down, 2016 Netflix featuring Joyce Byers.
Byers. Absolutely no idea what that is. So let's just go with another show no one's ever referenced on here. Shadowhunters, The Mortal Engines.
Let's just pause. Oh. Upside down, Dan. The upside down.
Stranger Things.
Stranger Things, yes. All right. Sarah D. Bunting, 2016 NBC. Welcome to Redacted. Everything is fine.
NBC? Redacted. Everything is fine. So I need a hint.
Featuring a character known as Eleanor Shellstrop.
Oh, The Good Place.
The Good Place, yes. Tara.
Yep.
2017, The CW. A great place to get away with it all. Now, don't forget.
Yeah.
There is a delicious hint at your disposal, or you can just go crazy and take a stab at those 2 points.
2017, The CW has so many shows. Oh, God, it's Riverdale.
Stay out of Riverdale.
Correct. 2 points, Riverdale. All right, everybody's last question coming at you, so let's get the scores, please, Tara.
It truly could not be closer. Sarah has 17. Dan has 18. I have 19.
Now, Dan, statistically speaking, do you think it could be closer than that?
Yes, we could all be tied.
Okay, yes. It could be closer, but it wouldn't be as fun.
Tara would like us to get closer so that she can tell us something. She just wants to talk.
All right, everybody's last question. Starting with Dan Cassino, 2017 Hulu, your body is no longer your own.
Body is no longer your own. Oh, God. Oh, no. I was thinking of the Joel Kinnaman show, but that's not Hulu. That's Netflix.
That's Netflix.
Share his body with somebody else. Okay. It's on Hulu. Your body is no longer your own. All right. So my thoughts, my first thought was like Legion because there's a thing there, but that wasn't Hulu. And then of course, and Twin Peaks is about that time, but Twin Peaks, and there's a, he doesn't have his body, but I don't think that's it. Because that wasn't Hulu.
World-class stalling, by the way. This is a man who's seen some stalling on the podcast.
You cannot see this, but there is a thin ribbon of smoke rising from his head.
Your body is no longer your own. All right, I'll have to take the hint.
Okay, your hint is a character named Fred Waterford.
Fred Waterford, your body is no longer your own. I have no idea who the hell Fred Waterford is. Fred Waterford. That's Handmaid's Tale. It's Handmaid's Tale.
It is.
Quite a way for us to discover what a misogynist you are, Dan.
Okay, Sarah D. Bundy, your last question. 2018 HBO, Take What's Yours.
Succession.
Yes,
nice.
Succession, final two. Tara, last question of regulation, 2019.
I just want to note, we are currently all tied up.
ABC.
Yes.
Saving the Day, Her Way.
2019 ABC?
Yep. You only need 1 point. But Tara likes to go out in a blaze of glory. I know her.
Oh, God. Okay, I'll take the hint.
Oh, you will take
I don't want you to buzz me.
Your hint is Dex Perios?
Oh, it's Stumptown.
Stumptown is correct. Did I get the pronunciation there?
Whew.
I think that's right.
All right, let's pretend it is. All right, final scores, please start.
I mean, it could be closer, but whatever. I guess I got schooled on that one. Dan has 19. Sarah has 19. I am truly one hair ahead with 20.
Oh, what a squeaker. All right, before we make this official, let's play the... oh my God, I just had a stroke. Before we make this official, let's play the tiebreaker. Winner subtracts three things away from their opponents. That's right. We're now, we're working back.
Okay.
We're making things more scarce because y'all got too many bonuses.
You got a lot of stuff.
You got too many bonuses.
It's true.
All right. So I will read you the tagline. I'll slowly give you more information. The first person to give me the correct show will take it. A hitman searching for some direction.
Barry.
Dan had a little brain freeze there. It was on the tip of his tongue, but Sarah sneaks in with the correct answer, Barry. So that means Value Guest and Tara now have three less things.
Oh.
Three less things.
Nicely done, Sarah.
Tragic. All right.
Thanks. So glad we're not in person right now. Hello.
Tara.
Tara. Me. Congratulations. Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Grade. We discussed the U.S. import of Would I Lie to You? Brackets, or did we? Before going around the dial with stops at Minx, The Ultimatum, Foreigners, Julia, and Atlanta. We played Dress Up for Dave S.'s extra credit. Well, Francoise's canon pitch for Top Chef All-Stars was cut from the menu. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time, which could not be closer, from Meredith. Next up, Better Call Saul, next week on EHG Prime. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
R.I.P. Stumptown,
Sarah D. Bunting,
the Salad Dressing Man,
and Dan Casino.
Why is there foam?
Thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Grade.
Prison breaks are organized with more efficiency and teamwork.
You guys all sound very different at 1.0 speed, really.
Sorry, Dan.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Tired of losing weight only to gain it all back? The weight loss experts at SlimRank.com have done the research. SlimRank.com ranks the safest, most effective GLP-1 programs that get and keep the weight off for good. Stop watching the scale go up and down. Go to SlimRank.com and pick America's number one weight loss program today. SlimRank.com. That's SlimRank.com. Your dream body is just a few months away. SlimRank.com.